Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
For the men and women who gathered 50 years ago, we're not there in search of some abstract idea.
Think of all the pictures you've seen of Washington that day, of the placards and the signs.
They were there seeking jobs as well as justice.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for the 28th of August, as you know already, because the story of this Wednesday is the story of half a century ago today, of a rally that was officially called a March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. President Obama spoke at the Lincoln Memorial today. We're going to let this one go for a little while.
We must remind ourselves that the measure of progress for those who marched 50 years ago was not merely how many blacks could join the ranks of millionaires. It was whether this country would admit all people who are willing to work hard, regardless of race, into the ranks of a middle-class life. The test was not, and never has been, whether the doors of opportunity are cracked a bit wider for a few. This is whether our economic system provides a fair shot for the many, for the black custodian and the white steelworker, the immigrant dishwasher, and the Native American veteran. To win that battle, to answer that call, this remains our great unfinished business.
There was, I suppose, some unfinished business on Wall Street today, but it does kind of seem beside the point somehow right now. Still, since it's what we do, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Make of this what you will, but Wall Street took the absence of ominous headlines about Syria as a positive sign today. A reason to buy, that is. But as we here wait for whatever it is that's going to happen over there, on the ground in the region there is still plenty going on. Refugees by the hundreds of thousands have left Syria, many of them winding up in camps in Jordan. The BBC's Karine Torbay is in Amman, Jordan. Karine, it's good to talk with you.
Thank you.
You've been out in these refugee camps the past couple of days. Tell us what it's like. What have you seen?
Well, the picture is very different from one refugee camp to the other. The biggest refugee camp is called a Za'atari refugee camp, and it's the second biggest refugee camp in the world. It's very much the prototype that you might imagine in your head of a camp. It's very crowded and packed. The other refugee camp is very different. It's a place that was opened recently, and it has only around 3,500 people, and the scale of it is much smaller than the first one.
In this first camp, the big one, the Za'atari camp with 140-something thousand people in it, how do people get by? What do they do? Is there a sort of a makeshift functioning market economy there?
At the moment, it has become like a mini village. It has its own market. It even has a very famous street inside the camp that is called the Champs-Élysées, as like the very famous French street. And the reason why it's called the Champs-Élysées is that it has many shops around. Even it has a bridal shop. And the hairdressers, the barber, anything is around there.
These shops, the bridal shop and the hairdresser shop and all of those, who's running those? Is that refugees who've gotten entrepreneurial?
Absolutely. Huh. It's a place that is full of Syrians, and it's a place run by Syrians, and the customers are Syrians. And in a way, it has a very good and positive effect because it's keeping people busy.
Yeah.
But the downside of it might be that this place is growing out of control. They know that there is some sort of smuggling and illegal businesses that are happening into this camp, and there might be no way to stop them.
What's going to happen when the Jordanian government and eventually the Turks and other countries that have been taking refugees, what's going to happen when they decide to stop, when they close their borders?
That's the question no one wants to answer, honestly, because there will always be a humanitarian need. And the countries around the region are appealing for the international community to help them with the burden financially, but also to help them by hosting a number of refugees in the European countries, in Australia, in America, and in the different countries in the world. So they're not the only countries bearing the brunt.
When you go out and about in Amman and talk to locals, what do they say? Are they aware of these camps? Do they care? Do they want them out?
Well, what started as a natural sympathy toward the refugees coming from Syria had grown with time into some sort of tension. They know that their countries are very much stretched in terms of resources, and they also kind of blame the Syrian refugees for all kind of economic malaise or for all kind of trouble.
Corinne Torbay for the BBC in Amman, Jordan. Corinne, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You might have heard by now that the New York Times website was hacked, or maybe you noticed when it didn't load for you. The group claiming responsibility calls itself the Syrian Electronic Army, which is who exactly? Like some 14-year-old genius hacker someplace? Marketplace's Adrienne Hill went looking for the army.
Sorry to disappoint you, Kai. I couldn't track them down.
I don't think we necessarily know exactly who the Syrian Electronic Army is.
Well, we don't know precisely who they are.
Nobody really knows who the Syrian Electronic Army exactly is.
But don't give up on my sleuthing skills. We do know some things. Chester Wisniewski is senior security advisor at Sophos.
They appear to be a group of hackers in Syria trying to draw media attention for supporting Bashar al-Assad.
And he says we know they aren't the world's most sophisticated hackers. Take the New York Times attack.
They, you know, tricked someone into disclosing their password so they could gain access to a system. And that's been their modus operandi in many of their attacks, is kind of attacking human frailty rather than technology.
It seems the Syrian Electronic Army sent fake emails to people at a company that registers domain names, basically publishers of a phone book for the internet. Someone fell for it, and the army?
It was effectively able to rewrite the white pages for the internet, pointing sites that should have gone to one location to locations that the Syrian Electronic Army controlled.
That's Matthew Prince. He's CEO of the web services company Cloudflare.
But it seems like if you're in the internet industry, you should know better.
It's, you know, the challenge is that the internet has, and something like email, has been built in such a way that it's really hard to authenticate when a message is actually coming from someone.
And when it's being faked. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Workers and management of the Bay Area Rapid Transit System up in San Francisco, BART as it's known, are in the middle of a 60-day cooling-off period. Thousands of BART workers walked off the job back in July to the great frustration of Bay Area residents trying to get to their own jobs. Some of the most vocal complaints were heard on social media, many of them from people employed in the region's hot technology businesses. That tension between the frustrated techies who are driving a booming economy and blue-collar workers who help them get to the office says a whole lot about the changing nature of work in this country. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has that story.
During the BART strike back in July, I talked to a guy named Richard White. He's the CEO of a tech startup in San Francisco called User Voice. He'd been on Facebook grumbling about the traffic that had been unleashed on his staff. And here's what he said about the striking BART workers.
My solution would be to pay them whatever the hell they want, get them back to work, and then go figure out how to automate all their jobs.
When this idea went out on the radio, some cheered White on, but many found it offensive. A few threatened to stop using White software, which happens to automate parts of the customer service experience for business. I wondered if White had had any second thoughts. So I went to his office in downtown San Francisco recently to ask. It had all the requisite tech startup accessories, beer-filled fridge in the break room, air hockey.
The largest air hockey table we could get in the building.
In the conference room next door, we sat down to talk.
All right.
And White was quick to tell me that he probably did sound a little callous with that automation proposal.
Here's this, like, rich CEO app. He gets mildly inconvenienced, and he just says, let's just do away with all these people and replace them with robots.
He said, when you're thinking about technology all day,
sometimes you do have sociopathic tendencies. You do things kind of in a vacuum, right? The prototypical worker will be displaced by this. It's different than saying Claire over here will be displaced by that.
But that is what's going to happen to Claire, he said.
Eventually, these things are going to be automated. It's not just BART, but it's lots of jobs. My point was, we need to think about these things.
White thinks about them a lot, he tells me. As he moves through his day, going to work, doing errands, he can almost see technology eating up the world.
Everywhere I walk in San Francisco, I notice there's a job that I don't think will be there in 15 years.
And so we went for a walk down 2nd Street toward the BART station near his office.
All the tech companies are in this area for the most part.
On the way, a taxi driver cruised by in his cab. At least that's what I saw. For White, that's a future
self-driving car.
And that checkout clerk at the corner store that we pass by, soon enough, he'll be a
self-service kiosk.
In White's view, automation isn't just an inevitable thing, it's a good thing. We should take the routine jobs people do and
automate as much of their day as possible so they can have more time to do the more valuable things.
But as we move down the streets of the technology capital of America, looking at the world through tech utopia tinted glasses, there's this voice in my head.
Isn't this the kind of stuff that's been worrying so many of the economists I talk to? That as technology advances at a faster and faster pace, it's vaporizing a lot of the middle-class jobs that used to employ people without college degrees or super specialized skills.
By this point, back on the streets of San Francisco, Richard White and I had arrived at our destination.
So we're right at the entrance to the Montgomery BART station.
What makes this place so interesting is that BART has become something of an anomaly in the new economy. With so much automation across all kinds of American industries, the thousands of unionized jobs at BART are a rare breed today in that they don't require college degrees or super specialized skills, but still bring in a decent middle-class salary. Take that station agent in the glass booth.
Come for the emergency exit.
Helping someone figure out which train to get on. A job like hers makes an average base salary of $64,000 a year. BART workers say the strike is about making sure those good salaries stay good. But in Richard White's eyes,
that's a lot of money to pay someone to answer questions about how to get from point A to point B. I have a map in my pocket at all times to tell me that.
He pointed at the Google Map app on his smartphone, meaning that station agent job?
That's clearly a job that could be automated.
We watched the agent from a distance for a while.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
She was smiling and wishing her customers a good day.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
At some point I asked White, so that whole automate her job thing. How do you feel about asking her how she would feel about it? He turned a little red.
Well, so she's such a nice lady, right?
Because I will probably afterwards ask her, but do you want to be
sure.
Part of it?
Yeah,
okay. We went up to the booth.
Hi.
White was a little shy, so I explained to the agent behind the glass that the guy I'm with thought she seemed really nice, but also that a robot could probably do most of her job. What do you think about that?
I don't just sit here all day.
Her name was Lanice Landry, and at first she was a little defensive. But then she tried to reason with White, listed the stuff she does, helping people figure out the route maps, assisting the elderly.
A lot of people don't speak English either.
White nodded, but he wasn't convinced.
That makes sense a lot. I wonder if you have to be right here, right? If we could have, like, you could just work from home and you could actually just have a screen here and they ask you questions.
Honey, you're talking about way futuristic stuff. Come on now. I've been in customer service for about 10 years, and I do realize people don't read. Hi.
As if on cue, a frantic-looking lady with a suitcase ran up to the window and interrupted our little debate.
Hi, sorry. No,
come on, honey. Can you add money?
She was rushing to the airport and couldn't figure out the ticket machine. Landry came out of her booth to help.
Okay, so press yes. And use your receipt for your records.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Landry turned back to us and said, see?
Everything can be automated. And a lot of people do feel better having another person there.
But if your job was automated, I asked, what would you do?
I would do my hobby, which will be hair and makeup and buy and sell houses.
And now White is nodding.
See, wouldn't that be perfect if she actually could, like, pursue her hobby?
And yes, that would be very cool. But it's not what seems to be happening, at least yet. In studies that have tracked people over the last few decades who lost jobs because of automation or globalization, those people usually wound up with lower-paying jobs or no jobs at all. Some economists say it'll take time, but ultimately automation will be a net good in the future, just like it was in the Industrial Revolution. Others aren't so sure. Richard White says these questions trouble him, too. But he says those are the kinds of complicated challenges that a techie like him can't solve on his own. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Coming up,
ping pong tables, climbing walls, you know, electric guitars in corners, dogs in every cubicle.
All right, Giv, what makes you want to come to work? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 48 points today, a third of 1%, closed at 14,824. The NASDAQ climbed 14 points, about 0.4%, ended things at 3,593. The S&P 500 advanced 4 points, 0.25%. 1634 at the end of the day. Energy shares pushed upward today. Chevron bubbled up 2.5%. ExxonMobil flowed 2.33% higher. That's a second consecutive day, by the way, of energy company gains. Tech companies rallied. Groupon up 1.5% today. Plans to roll out a network of warehouses to support its business and compete with companies like online retailer Amazon. Speaking of which, Amazon clicked up nearly 0.25% today. TiVo recorded a 5.5% gain. Get it? Recorded. All right. The digital recorder company announced a second quarter profit today. In retail, youth clothing company Express zipped up 6.5% as the company announced a jump in same-store sales. And jewelry store Zale showing almost 33.0% brighter today after reporting higher-than-expected fourth-quarter comparable sales. That is, my friends, a whole lot of cubic zirconium, boy. You are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The United Nations marks the International Day Against Nuclear Tests. They say nearly 2,000 tests have taken place since the first one in 1945. The Commerce Department releases its second estimate for gross domestic product for the second quarter. And something for your morning coffee, Krispy Kreme releases quarterly earnings. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you spent time on Twitter this week, you might have seen this. The former CEO of Ticketmaster, Nathan Hubbard, announced in 140 characters or less, of course, that he is joining Twitter, the company, as head of commerce. Sarah McCammon looks at the new frontier of online shopping.
Twitter is kind of like Santa Claus. It knows what you've been doing. It knows when you're awake.
It knows all the tweets you had made, so it's somehow able to understand what are the things that you might like.
Darpan Munjal is co-founder of online retailer Fashionera.com. For instance, he says, you might tweet about the hiking trip you're planning next week, and Twitter could point you to a company selling outdoor gear. But how would that work? Twitter will have to figure that out, says Sucharita Molpuru. She's a retail analyst with Forrester Research.
The challenge for Twitter is, how are you going to make money off of these commerce companies? How do you become like Google?
She says Twitter has experimented with sponsored tweets and partnered with companies like American Express for special offers. However the business model takes shape, e-commerce consultant Sally McKenzie says Twitter will have to prove that it can help retailers find customers.
And to consumers, Twitter's going to need to prove that it's really a fun and interesting and easy place to shop.
Without annoying users who are already tired of ads. Sucharita Molpuru says as Twitter tries to become a bigger player in e-commerce, you can expect to see more experimentation in your feed.
We'll see, you know, a lot of things thrown against the wall, and, you know, we'll see if anything, you know, resonates.
And if it does, Twitter might be able to turn its millions of users into hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
Kids and social media can be just a whole mess of trouble waiting to happen, in part because it's basically impossible for adults to keep track of every tweet and Snapchat and status update out there. There is a school district here in California that thinks monitoring all that social media could be one key to keeping its kids safe, or safer. So it's hired a company to do all that monitoring. Shannon Mullen has the story.
The Glendale Unified School District is shelling out $40,000 to monitor students' public social media posts. The service from GeoListening tracks keywords and other data for signs that kids might hurt themselves or others, then alerts the school. Chris Friedrich is the company's CEO.
Every single post is reviewed by a human being before it makes a report for a school district.
Schools don't give the company any information about students. The technology to monitor social media is not new, but Friedrich says he wants to use it to fight social problems like cyberbullying and suicide. Susan Ettlinger is a social data industry analyst at Altimeter Group. She says there is a need for adults to better understand kids' social data.
I absolutely think it could become an actual business. I think it's fraught with a lot of potential pitfalls. Accuracy, context, the quality of the technology, it just goes on.
At the International Association of Privacy Professionals, CEO Trevor Hughes says kids do need some privacy. And more than ever, that conflicts with their school's need to keep them safe.
That exact same friction plays out in all sorts of other scenarios. We are certainly seeing it in the current debate over national security and public privacy with regards to the NSA.
GeoListening says it recently hired a lawyer with expertise in children's privacy and social networks. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
There's a tendency in corporate America to focus on the bottom line, which makes total sense because they are businesses, not charities. But in the pursuit of profits, companies are sometimes quite focused on cutting costs to boost those profits. Other companies, though, take another tack. I'm talking perks with a capital P here, people. Nancy Kane from the Harvard Business School is back with us. Hey, Nancy, good to talk to you again.
It's always a pleasure, Kai.
The trend with companies writ large right now is cutting. They're cutting jobs, they're cutting benefits, they're just cutting. But there are more than a handful of companies doing another thing, right? Taking another route.
There are. There are really two counter trends. One is one that we've heard a lot about in the tech sector, Kai, and that is lots and lots of perks, right, in the office, sometimes outside of the office, for scarce, often engineering talent as a way to recruit them and keep them. But the second are companies that really put the employee at the top of their chain of priorities as a way of building business and encouraging satisfied, loyal, advocating customers.
Is this like ping pong tables at Google? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, ping pong tables, climbing walls, you know, electric guitars in corners, dogs in every cubicle. But there are other companies doing the same thing outside the tech sphere and have been for a long time. So you think about the private cleaning products company, SC Johnson.
Yeah.
They do all kinds of things for their employees. They have a concierge service. Wow. They have a fabulous fitness and education facility on the corporate campus. Campbell Soup has kindergarten and after-school daycare on the headquarters. HubSpot, which is a really interesting little marketing company that measures the effectiveness of internet marketing.
Yeah.
They have beer all day long in an open fridge.
Oh, man. Really?
All day long.
Okay, two questions. Are they taking new applicants? And two, how do they get anything done?
You know, Brian Halligan, the founder, swears that this promotes a lot of creativity and collaboration and just, you know, good old-fashioned positive energy.
This must all accrue somehow to the bottom line.
Absolutely. So if you look at some of the measures around this, employee productivity, turnover, which is a big, big deal for companies of lots of different ilks, engagement numbers, those numbers are higher for these companies than for other competitors in their respective classes. Right? Remember, this is all in great contrast, you know, buy low and sell high and eat your workers up to do that.
Yeah.
You know, if these companies way outperform the Dow, the NASDAQ by by 8-to-1 ratios in some cases if you take a horizon as long as 5 to 10 years. So the idea in these companies, in their cultures, is the employee is at the front of the line. And by doing that, customers and then shareholders win.
Okay, if this is so smart and all these companies are doing so well, how come you, a professor of business history at Harvard University, are calling them out as the exceptions, and how come they're not the norm? You know what I mean?
So I think they will be the norm, Kai. I think companies like Southwest or Whole Foods or Starbucks, I think they are the tip of the new iceberg.
Hmm.
So the dark satanic mills that have really at some grossly general level characterized a lot of the way that capitalistic enterprises have treated employees are truly a thing of the past. And the companies that don't get that are walking backwards into the future.
So at Harvard, you get what? Like access to the faculty club? What else?
I get access to the faculty club, you know, and I get to walk across Harvard Yard. I get to say I'm from Harvard. but, you know, most of all, I get to jump and swim and revel in Widener Library and every book you can possibly imagine.
There you go. Nancy Kane at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, just to get us back to where we started today, the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom 50 years ago. The marchers that day had an actual list of demands. It was printed in the program of the day's events. Item number 8 on that list was a call for minimum wage legislation. $2 or more an hour is what they wanted. You run $2 in 1963 through an inflation calculator today, you get $15.27. All right, we're done. We're out of here. That's Marketplace from APM on this, what is it, Wednesday today. The Dow up 48 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ gained 14 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 advanced 4 points. That is a quarter of 1%. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.